Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we'll be talking about what Jared Kushner's comments at the Library of Congress yesterday say about America's involvement in Middle East politics and many of the other things going on in that region. We're also going to be talking quite a bit here today in the aftermath of the healthcare debate, where progressive politics goes from here and some other issues of concern there as well. But before we can move on. The city of Baltimore, Maryland, is awash in controversy as the increased use of police body cameras has led to now two incidents of police officers being caught on camera planting drug evidence. As we reported to you 2 weeks ago, officers were caught placing drugs on camera, not knowing the camera was on, and then turning it on and staging the finding of these same drugs they just planted. Police Commissioner Kevin Davis poured fuel on the flames yesterday by releasing a memo telling officers not to plant evidence on camera. However, he used the phrase, quote unquote, recreate, as in recreate a scene. That is something basically making it seem like it's not illegal. And this has caused an uproar as it relates to BPD's complete sham attempt to cover for these officers. They've been claiming, shockingly, that the officers were not planting evidence in this first case, just recreating how they found it. How that even makes sense, given that the video clearly shows them planting evidence, then trying to create the perception that they found it during a search, which is the definition of planting evidence. I really don't know, but that's what they're saying. So far, 41 drug and gun cases have been dropped by Baltimore prosecutors as a result of the unreliability of the officers involved, given the fact that they are on camera planting evidence. And that, in and of itself, should tell you something. If these officers were all so innocent, then why would the DA not be willing to continue to use them as witnesses in cases that are before them? Obviously, it's because it can't be easily explained away because they planted evidence on video. There are over 100 cases that are now being investigated to be potentially dropped over this video. So this is going to be an ongoing story. And of course, as we mentioned at the outset yesterday, another video came out appearing to show Baltimore police officers planting evidence. It was actually a series of body camera videos this time, and it appears to show several officers conspiring here to plant marijuana and heroin in a car after a traffic stop. The state's attorney has dismissed that case, lending credence to the fact that this evidence was indeed manufactured out of whole cloth by these officers. This is the third major scandal this year for Baltimore cops, or two if you count this body camera thing, all both incidents together. In March of this year, seven officers on an elite gun crime task force were charged with federal racketeering charges for robbing citizens, filing false reports, and committing overtime fraud. And of course, this follows the Justice Department report released just last year about the Baltimore police. It stated in a quite detailed way that there was a, quote, pattern in practice, that is widespread, unconstitutional behavior by the Baltimore police. So, just to reconfirm here, the Baltimore police have a history and current pattern in practice of routinely on a large scale violating the constitutional rights of the residents in that city. And now it appears that the rollout of police body cameras has caught the fact that Baltimore cops aren't afraid to plant evidence either. In a fairly unexpected turn of events, the Trump administration is expected to use the Justice Department to sue colleges over admissions policies they deem to be discriminatory against white people, according to reporting in the New York Times. Shockingly, it appears this frontal assault on affirmative action will be housed in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. This, of course, is a longtime hobby horse of the right wing who claim that college admissions preferences that take race into account somehow discriminate against white people. And this, of course, has never actually been proven true, and the Supreme Court reaffirmed this in 2016 when they upheld race-based affirmative action in their ruling in Fisher v. Texas. And honestly, before we go on, it's worth noting one key aspect of that Fisher v. Texas case, and that is Ms. Fisher was actually not rejected based on race. ProPublica did a deep dive back in 2013, looking at the claims in the case. Let me relate a bit of their reporting here to you. Quote, applicants who did not make the cut were evaluated based on two scores. One allotted points for grades and test scores. The other, called a personal achievement index, awarded points for two required essays, leadership, activities, service, and quote-unquote special circumstances. Those included the socioeconomic status of the student or the student's school, coming from a home with a single parent or one where English wasn't spoken, and race. Even among those students, Fisher did not particularly stand out. I'm still quoting from ProPublica here. Court records show her grade point average and SAT scores were good, but not great for the highly selective flagship university. As a result, university officials claim in court filings that even if Fisher received points for her race and every other personal achievement factor, the letter she received in the mail still would have said no. And it's true, and this is important here, this is again from ProPublica, it's true that the university, for whatever reason, offered provisional admission to some students with lower test scores and grades than Fisher. Five of those students were black or Latino. 42 were white. So right there, that should raise a number of issues for you. The idea that affirmative action is reverse discrimination against white people is false. But of course, you're saying, oh, give me more evidence. Well, I've got it for you. While the issue of affirmative action is primarily presented as a black-white issue in a very diverse country, it's clearly more than that. It's very instructive, then, to look at the white versus Asian-American divide here when we consider the admissions situation. Now, in 2009, Princeton did a study that found Asian students had to score 140 points higher than whites to have the same chance at admission to leading universities. The study examined other factors as well and determined that white applicants were three times more likely to be admitted to selective schools than Asians who had the exact same academic record. There have been two recent lawsuits, one of Harvard and another of Yale, that examined this same issue. They found, interestingly enough, that despite the doubling of the Asian American population in the past 20 years, the percentage of Asian American students at both these schools remained almost exactly the same for 20 straight years. It's also worth taking into account here so-called legacy admissions that give preferential treatment to those whose parents attended the school, which is pretty hotly contested but almost universally practiced norm in higher education. One study in 2011 looked at 30 elite universities and found that having a parent as a legacy gave you a 45% greater chance of getting in than someone who didn't. Having any sort of legacy connection at all gave one a 23% better chance. Since as recently as 1976, 84% of all college students were white, and that going to college in general improves your earnings potential, legacies are overwhelmingly white and better off, hence why they're so controversial. And there's also the fact that white women are the largest beneficiaries of preferential policies like affirmative action, something that, you know, Time Magazine, Vox, a number of academic studies have also noted. And then on top of that, there's this issue of black dropout rates. This new Justice Department effort is allegedly going to look at black dropout rates at colleges to see which ones are allegedly focusing too much on race and not enough on merit. It's a paternalistic excuse that's been used by many, including Justice Scalia in the Fisher case, to oppose affirmative action, stating that minority students are pushed into positions that they aren't really ready for, with the subtext being that they took a spot from a white person who was ready. Well, some researchers at the University of Wisconsin actually decided to do something crazy. They studied this. What did they find? Quote, students do not earn higher grades and are no more or less likely to drop out of a school where they are, quote unquote, overmatched and are less likely to drop out than they would have been had they attended a less demanding institution. There are also issues like discrimination in standardized tests like the SAT, which are certainly well documented over a number of years. Also the impact of the school-to-prison pipeline, which, as we know, disproportionately targets black students for more discipline than whites. Quote, 46% of colleges are gathering information on disciplinary records on their individual application materials, and 27% collect that information from common applications, end quote. So disciplinary records obviously do matter, and this means that more black people can get knocked out of the box because of the racism in the criminal justice system. Here's the bottom line, really. Affirmative action does not exist for some completely random reason. It was a practice started under President Kennedy as a recognition of the fact that for years, higher education in America, literally hundreds of years, closed almost all of its doors to women and black people, as well as erecting shameful quotas against Jews. This meant that many, many very qualified people were denied admission, which did not just hurt them individually, but is directly related to the structural inequalities between white and black people today. Clearly, the majority of college students are white. When you look at legacy admissions, the school-to-prison pipeline, the clearly racist quota system designed to cap Asian American students at elite universities, you combine that with the impact of structural inequality in employment, pay rates, housing, and so on, and you can see why affirmative action is still crucial. And it's also worth remembering that these aren't even actually racially based quotas at this stage in the game. There's been so much litigation around this. The University of Texas system that the Supreme Court upheld considers many other things, as I pointed out there, leadership for one as well, including race. And ultimately, it's that there is a vast range of factors. That's how almost all affirmative action programs are structured now, including the University of Michigan as well, that 2003 had the affirmative action case before the Supreme Court. It isn't reverse racism. It's a proactive attempt to address the various structural inequalities that result in white male students being favored, It's looking to them, even them out, and create opportunity for people often looked over, not because they lack merit, but because of racism and bigotry. They are perceived to lack merit. This Trump action really has to be placed in the context of what his administration is doing. Increases in immigration raids and tightening of immigration policy, the increase of law and order policing and the embrace of police brutality, the championing of mass incarceration, a voter suppression commission that's masquerading as a voter fraud commission, and now this. It's a war on black and brown America, and when you combine that with what Republicans want to do on health care, which failed, and taxes, which could still happen, it's also a war on the poor, waged by the most plutocratic cabinet in decades. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined in our conversation as we're switching gears here by John Liss, who's the executive director of New Virginia Majority, and Valerie Irvin, who's a senior advisor at the Working Families Party. Thank you both so much for joining the show.
Great to be with you.
Yep, thanks for having me again.
So I wanted to start here with the aftermath here of the healthcare battle. I don't know if aftermath is the right word. It may not be 100% over, but let's just say so far. Valerie, I'll start with you here. I mean, we're only a few months into the Trump administration, so I don't even know if turning point is the right word, but it does seem like this has a feel of kind of a turning point. A grassroots movement kind of took hold of the narrative about what this healthcare, quote unquote, healthcare bill was really about, and turned the tables on Congress and on the president. Seems like a pretty significant thing. What are your thoughts in the wake of what I think we can call a victory?
I think we have a victory for now. And the last time I was with you, we talked about how the will of the people sometimes leads, and I think in this case, the will of the people spoke loudly over all the political shenanigans. I really do believe that because we at Working Families and so many of our allies and friends across the country staged civil disobedience in district offices and Senate offices, we had Resist Trump Tuesdays, people were organized online live stream protests, people were very, very well amped up about the what almost happened was, 22 million American people losing their health care. I believe this debate has just really moved people in a straight line towards single payer. And I think that what's happening right now is that all of the people who have been involved in the resist movement across this country see this as a victory, but this is just step one in our, march towards single payer.
No, great points. John, I'm curious your thoughts here in the wake of all of this. I mean, pretty amazing, I thought, to see, even people like Tom Cotton seem a little cowed by grassroots protesters in his own state.
I'd say it's a dual thing. I think Valerie hit pretty well the sort of massive response and the militant response, and I think its impact, and its impact on those so-called swing Republicans. I think the other side to it is it sort of revealed the emperor to have few, if any, clothes. And, and I think it's creating all kinds of, making apparent all kinds of splits within the Republican Party and the sort of more reactionary camp. So I think that's another opportunity that could play out over the next couple of years.
No, I think so for sure. And I'm curious, Valerie, what you're thinking sort of now in the wake. I mean, I've seen that some Democrats and some Republicans are now working together to allegedly shore up some elements of the ACA. I mean, does that make sense to you? Or should Democrats be focusing a little bit more on, maybe an aggressive single payer push or whatever it may be?
Well, first of all, I don't think they have time to do much because they're in a real time crunch right now. But I think that the folks who have been out in the streets pushing back hard are really starting to understand that this is an ideological fight, and it's also all about the money. And as the Republicans move forward to their whatever their tax bill is going to look like, I think all of this is sort of like meshed together. So the healthcare fight isn't over until we figure out what the Republicans are going to bring to Congress. Around their whole desire to give this massive tax cut to the richest people in this country. They first tried to do that through the ACA or to repeal and replace Obamacare. That didn't work. So my fear is that we're just actually getting started really fighting back on the real ideological front about what these people actually believe. They don't believe government should be in the business of healthcare or entitlement, period.
You know, John, one element of this that I'm sort of curious your thoughts on here, and especially being based in Virginia, is how do you think this should shape the view sort of the quote-unquote Trump voter, the rank-and-file person? I mean, I think so much of progressive politics in the past few months has been, you know, how do we reach out to these so-called red areas? Obviously, regardless of party identity, basically no one really liked this bill. I mean, any real lessons you think we can draw from this? Or, I mean, is it kind of a one-off, given that this is a very sort of, you know, particularly potent issue?
I draw a parallel to when the government shut down, I think it was 2013, and we were doing voter work here in Virginia, and all of a sudden all these folks realized that they were, oh my God, I'm a government employee and this election matters. It was probably the best single turnout message we've ever had. And so I would say, and Virginia does these annual RAM, rural area mobile clinics, RAM clinics. And there's literally thousands of people gathering under tents to get their teeth pulled out and their one shot at a doctor. And I think this sort of helped to expose that, yes, there's a lot of folks, white folks too, poor white folks, poor rural white folks, who are without health care or are covered by Obamacare. So I think it sort of has highlighted that constituency in a certain way. And so that's part of it. The other part, which is more on the Democratic side, and I'm not sure how well the lessons are being learned, and this goes back to the 2016 general election or even the primary, is, you know, as we headed into a gubernatorial race here in Virginia, I'm not clear if the party has really figured out, in terms of race, particularly African-American and immigrant, Latinx, and other voters, how it's going to message and work with folks and develop programs that actually address people's sort of needs. I mean, people can talk. They can talk about handgun control, or the gubernatorial candidate here in Virginia calls Trump a narcissistic maniac. I mean, I'm glad about his medical diagnosis, but it's really that's not going to move voters on the doors. And so I'm just concerned about on both sides. A, how do you sort of galvanize this you know, white working class, disenfranchised, uninsured constituency? And then B, how do you move the sort of mainstream Democratic Party to not keep doing failed programs and failed approaches to election? I'm deeply personally concerned because lose this election and you've got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican governor, the trifecta, and all bets are off in terms of all the crazy stuff that could come out of there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Valerie, I want your thoughts on this, but we're going to take a break here and come right back on this point here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are still here. I should also mention live on 105.5 in the Washington, D.C. area. And we continue to be joined by John Liss from New Virginia Majority and Valerie Irvin from the Working Families Party. And Valerie, I wanted to get your thoughts on this issue we left off talking on, which is, you know, maybe some of the longer term sort of base building strategic lessons from this healthcare vote, what it says maybe about doing outreach to the so-called red states, the Trump voters. And I think John's point there at the end is sort of the challenge I think a lot of progressives are thinking is sort of how do you reach out to those folks and also really try to motivate, you know, the young millennial, a lot of them left-leaning voters in more excitable ways. How do you make that combination?
Well, in this healthcare debate, we got to see that we did go deeper into red states. I know that Bernie Sanders made lots of pit stops in red states, but when you see that only 12% of Americans were supporting dumping Obamacare, that tells you that this issue of health care cut across every single family, no matter their race or their geography. And I think what we're learning on the left is that these issues that affect every single American every single day are the issues that we're going to have to dig down deeper in as we're approaching the 18 cycle. I think the issue of health care is not going away. clearly we're getting signals from the, you know, the Senate that they want to, you know, get together in this bipartisan way and try to fix what's wrong with the ACA. And there are issues that need to be dealt with for sure. But I think that every day that Americans have to check in with themselves about the fact that Medicare is so important in every single state. And I wanted to kind of pivot this and talk a little bit about how women played in the healthcare debate, because Murkowski of Alaska and Collins of Maine from the very beginning opposed what the Republicans were trying to do to healthcare. But when you really look at who across America are the people who take care of the healthcare in their families, it's women. And it was women who were going to like turn out to be real big losers if this thing didn't go the right way. So I think there's lots of different ways to sort of dig into the fight that we're in right now, because I think it has tentacles in the next election cycle, and it's the big issue where lots of other issues sort of like are attached.
Well, and Valerie, let me ask you that follow-up there, because I think that's the pivot is very prescient point there, because it raises another issue in my mind, which is and relates to this, is, you know, how do we draw our red lines? Because I think that was the controversy earlier this week with the DCCC coming out and saying they would fund candidates who were pro-life candidates. A lot of people felt, I think it was clear that was, you know, clearly saying that a woman's right to choose was more or less kind of an optional issue, not a foundational issue. You know, the strategy of that, it's people can parse it however they want. But nevertheless, it does sort of seem to me that it raises a question, you know, on gender issues, on racial issues, that, you know, there's obviously strong polarization a lot of times. But the only way to really embrace those communities sometimes is to be willing to risk a little bit of something in terms of broad appeal. But I wonder your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget that the day after Trump was sworn in as president, the largest march that we've seen in years and years, millions of women marched across the entire planet. And one of their biggest issues was women's health care. And I think that we don't want to like leave that off the radar, because women as a voting bloc are huge, and they're motivated and they're charged up. And I think that women and millennials, for example, in this Resist Trump movement have been the people that we continually see showing up for acts of civil disobedience, for showing up in district offices and visiting Senate offices and shutting things down when they needed to be shut down. I think we're learning the lessons of the civil rights movement when we want to take a page back out of that we don't want to like muddy the water up with too many issues, because this is why Democrats lose. They're so issue driven that they want to throw everything up against the wall. Like, it can't be that way. We need to sort of agree what the major issues are going to be that we're willing to go to the mat on. And I think healthcare clearly is at the top of that list.
John, I'm curious what you think about this question. I saw it play out a little bit in Virginia late last week. I saw some folks criticizing the Democratic gubernatorial candidate for not being sufficiently against some of these pipelines that are going to be crisscrossing the state. Obviously, that's a highly controversial issue all over the country right now. Your thoughts on this issue of sort of developing sort of red lines, core issues, and alliances like that?
Sure. Two things. One is just following up on sort of women and women sort of motoring a lot of this change. Here in Virginia, there's a record number, to the extent there's records on it, 61 women running for the 100 House seats, 59 of them are Democrat. That's like pretty much a doubling from the last electoral cycle. And you could see in turnout, you know, women were really leading the way across the board. So that's one thing that's really exciting and something to build on. I would just say we've nominated a Democratic candidate for governor who takes money from the energy monopoly and has been neutral, just calling for tough for whatever, passing whatever regulations, but has been, you know, pro-fracking or pro-pipeline, if you will, not fracking necessarily. And at the same time, I'm really clear that we need to get this guy elected. Our alternatives are minimal, but we really need to fight for a legislature that's going to hold him accountable if Northam does get elected. I would just say it shows the sort of complicated, murky politics within the Democratic Party that in many ways has embraced some of the worst aspects of neoliberalism, in many ways has embraced almost a Sarah Palin kind of approach to energy, which is, you know, it's all good. And I think it's part of the fight for, you know, really a transition. How do you actually create a just transition to move away from sort of carbon-based fuel? And linked to that, which we often don't want to talk about, is what does that mean in terms of how housing is set up? Urban areas versus suburban sprawl, putting limits on development and developers. There's a whole bunch of things embedded in a lifestyle built around cheap and always flowing carbon-based energy. And I think that's a break that I think we in the sort of popular movement have to keep pushing. And I want to be clear, we are pretty unequivocal that we need to get Ralph Northam elected as governor of Virginia. Yet at the same time, we need to hold his feet to the fire around energy and a number of other policies.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something to that?
Yeah, please. Go ahead, Valerie.
Because I really appreciated what you just laid out in terms of what's happening in Virginia and how you use the word murky, the murky waters we travel in the sort of political sense. But I really do believe that when we're looking at the top of the ticket, like a governor, that we have to understand that the way we really build the power is in the legislature, and it's in city councils around the state of Virginia. We're facing the same thing in Maryland, although we have a much better cadre of people that we're going to be able to choose from in the primary. But I think that at Working Families, we are really trying to do as much as we can to build our own pipeline around the country of really progressive candidates that we can support in the state houses, where the Republicans, who have been very savvy about this over the last couple of decades, have redrawn the lines to, you know, help more Republicans get elected. And so we have a really tough job ahead of us. But I really do believe that to build the kind of political power that we need on the left is going to have to be through, you know, winning lots of legislative seats to balance out the fact that we have very few good options at the top of the ticket.
Mm. Well, and I just have to say, as a complete aside here, but a shout out to my home state of Virginia. It was a woman, Mary Sue Terry, who people said could never win, who was the first person to ever get over 1 million votes in the state. So point of pride there for us. But, John, I didn't know if you were trying to get in there or if you were just agreeing.
No, I largely agree. I was going to ask Valerie to send us over a couple of those Maryland candidates. It seems like they've got a surplus. And also I want to acknowledge that, you know, the laws are set up in Virginia having off-year elections when turnout, particularly turnout among voters of color, drops down sometimes into the single digits. We have a system set up and lines drawn to make our job difficult. But it's true, at the state level is really where the rubber meets the road, where you actually have to change. In our case, it's almost a 2-to-1 majority in the state house. Until you change that, you have difficulty. The governor is basically functioning at best is a veto machine. That's the best you can hope. So we really, and the other thing I would say, because of the structures set up, it's not a 1 year process or a one election process to turn around in Virginia. If it's 66-34, there's some sort of Pollyannish sort of estimations. Oh, there's 17 districts where Hillary Clinton won in 2016 that could then become Democrat. I mean, I wish the world worked that way, but I just think that's a gross overestimation of what we've got. I think we got to hone in. If we pick up 5 to 7 seats this year, that's great. And if we pick up a few more between 2020 and the census, that puts us in a better position. So I think it's essentially for us, it's a 4-year strategy to build out and move towards greater governing power and building a left pole or progressive pole within the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Maryland, a lot of good things going on in Maryland there for our listeners who don't know. Bail reform, a number of issues really moving forward on the state level in a way that they aren't in other places around the country, is certainly worth checking out. But switching gears a little bit here, and Valerie, I'll start with you on this. It's more of a question sort of about the importance of framing, because I was thinking about this morning, seeing Trump announce this affirmative action thing, because sort of in the top line sort of big media that everyone knows, one of the biggest sort of storylines is this idea that, well, Trump hasn't been able to get too much done. He's bogged down. The Russia thing is making it difficult for him to legislate, and which, you know, I certainly understand that in some senses, and on some big things he's fallen down, but certainly on immigration, the voter fraud commission, voter suppression commission, now this affirmative action thing, the police brutality thing. It seems like when it comes to attacking communities of color, and certainly climate change too, Trump is moving super fast here. And that's something that shouldn't be sort of lost sight of in sort of this broader sort of context and narrative.
Absolutely. I was listening to your segment before we came on, and I think what Trump is doing needs a narrative from the left. And I think it's really important that we don't get lost in the fight, the big fight on health care and tax reform, while quietly, you know, this attorney general is going after civil rights, you know, things that we fought for many, many years. They're slowly and very methodically going after them. And, you know, what's really frightening about this to me is that this is part of Trump's sort of base building among his white working class voters who think he can do no wrong. There is a subtext of it's racial discrimination. There's a subtext going on here throughout the Trump, you know, run for president, how, you know, white supremacists came out, and there's this really ugly thing churning. And we cannot allow that to go unanswered. And so I think for those of us on the left, and especially as a person of color, as I am, it sends a chill up my spine that I'm not hearing any response to this news as it came out yesterday that, you know, they're going to try to unravel all the work that was done to get civil rights legislation passed in this country. So it's something that, you know, you did a great job in your segment, but I think that conversation needs to be lifted up around the country. And I'm not hearing that.
Well, thank you, first and foremost. John, I'm curious your thoughts on this question. I mean, I'm pretty cynical about, like, as how bad things can get, but I've been honestly surprised with how Sessions, just how aggressively he's moved on a number of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is hopefully there's enough animosity within this Trump camp. He gets canned. But the bigger thing is that, yeah, race and racism and sort of national chauvinism are like the centerpieces sort of holding Trump and his agenda together. And that's like he can do sort of symbolic acts. I mean, essentially, he's in a position almost like a reverse Obama. While Obama did a number of executive acts around the margins wherever he could to sort of make some small improvements, Trump's going to be doing, you know, undoing virtually all of those and doing the reverse in terms of coming out, you know, whether it's on affirmative action, whether it's on immigration. He revealed something else today about his plan there, which is basically give us some talented workers that our businesses can exploit, but the rest of you all can go home. So I think there's just, yeah, race is really central. I mean, the thing interesting, if you look at sort of right-wing populism, it's a sort of producerist logic, which basically says that white working people and a certain segment of sort of capitalists are the only ones who produce value. And you've got leeches who are basically people of color, bankers and Jewish folks who are basically the non-productive elements of society. So I don't think he's said anything that direct, but to me, that's like the line running right through most of his domestic policies.
Right, but he doesn't have to say anything direct. I mean, that's all the dog whistle politics. And what Trump did when he was running for president, he made it okay for people to just say the racist stuff out loud. And the reason Republicans are fighting back against the threat of taking Jeff Sessions out of his office is because they know what he's doing as the attorney general. All the more reason for us to sort of begin to elevate what's happening here, because we're getting lost in the news cycle of what did Trump tweet this morning and how many people are going to get fired in the West Wing. Meanwhile, slowly and methodically, Sessions is unraveling. We're going to wake up one day in a year from now and say, oh my God, how did that happen? So we just need to stay very vigilant.
I think so, for sure, and very well taken point. And I wanted to circle back around to a related point, but something you raised a little bit earlier, Valerie, and that's the issue of sort of candidate pipelines and who's running, because I think that's also sort of key in terms of fighting back against these kind of supremacist policies is showing that, you know, a lot of that stuff is just not true. I think about that, the South Carolina special election, and I'm sure both of you guys probably saw this article on how there was like 132,000 eligible black voters in that district, and the guy who won, the Republican, got like 44,000 votes. But the candidate they ran, Archie Parnell, I think it was his name, he seemed like a nice guy, but like white, middle-aged, Goldman Sachs guy, had lived most of his adult life in Switzerland, of all places. And it just sort of thinks, well, I mean, no wonder you lost. I mean, you didn't have the base of people who are most likely to vote for you. Your candidate seemed to have no organic connection to those folks. So I'm curious, Valerie, how you guys are approaching that in working families and trying to reach into new sectors and develop folks.
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the things that I work on in Maryland and some other states for working families is pipeline, creating a pipeline of candidates who can run for school board, which is very important, who can run for city council, county commission, really actually creating a pipeline of progressive candidates who, when these big jobs open up, like governor or U.S. Senate or Congress, we have done what the right wing has been doing for like 40, 50 years, and that is growing our own. And so Working Families is very dedicated and enmeshed in pipeline project work in Maryland, for example. We're doing really great things there. We're going out and very methodically seeking out candidates that have our same worldview, and we train them and we get them ready to run for office. And so I think that the left, there are a lot of organizations that are doing it. It's not just the Working Families Party. But we think that this is the way that we tackle getting these state legislatures back, for example. So it's really great work. It's very tedious, but that means that we have to have a 10-year plan moving out, and this is what we're starting to do now. New York's had a pipeline project for many, many years, and they've been very, very successful in the state of New York. So we're just taking what they have and we're replicating it in many states across the country.
Well, I look forward to being able to report on that and all the great work that both of you guys are doing. I really, really appreciate you joining the show here for a couple segments. It's John Liss from New Virginia Majority and Valerie Irvin from the Working Families Party. Thank you both again for joining the show. We are going to take a break here. We're going to come back with more. We're going to be talking with Mitchell Plitnick a little bit about things in the Middle East here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the, I guess, continued and ongoing issues coming out of the Middle East here today. And we are very happy to be joined by Mitchell Plitnick, who's a political analyst and the former vice president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Mitchell, thank you so much for being with us again.
Sure thing. Glad to be back.
So I wanted to start here with, I don't know, it's partially a funny story, but partially not that funny. The little story about Jared Kushner's off-the-cuff talk there to the Library of Congress yesterday. Made a few comments about the Israel-Palestine conflict I found interesting. The one that's getting the most headlines is something that, quote, what do we even bring to the table that is special? And I just thought to myself, wow, that's an extraordinary statement from someone who is apparently the lead envoy when it seems obvious to me that the one thing clearly is the U.S. relationship with Israel. But your thoughts here on Mr. Kushner's hot mic comments.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's remember, I mean, Jared Kushner has nothing but the most rudimentary understanding of this conflict. This isn't something he's ever been particularly involved with before. It's nothing he has a background in. You know, as we all know, that diplomacy is completely new to him. And he's never really, you know, he's never, despite the fact that he's certainly been involved in the U.S. Jewish community, he's never really been particularly active on Israel, even from whatever point of view. So it's not surprising that he would look at this and just be completely befuddled. I mean, people with a lot more experience in this than him have been befuddled. What I think is sort of interesting about this is that he actually misses the fact that politically in the United States, as absurd as it may actually sound, Republicans, and particularly Republicans as independent as Donald Trump, is actually in as good a position as you can be as president politically to make a real difference on this issue. Now, Trump is clearly not inclined to do so. Benjamin Netanyahu is a friend that has completely knelt before him as other leaders have, and then we know what that does to Trump. But the potential is really there. Trump is not at all politically beholden to any of the forces in this country that push hard on the Israel issue, with the possible exception of Christian evangelicals, but they overwhelmingly supported him in the election, despite the fact that he actually, at that time, when he was campaigning in the South, said that, you know, maybe we should try and look at both sides, or some words to that effect. I forget what they were exactly now. So he's actually in the position where he could do more than, for example, a Barack Obama, but he's clearly not going to, and he clearly does not have Trump or Kushner clearly do not have the capacity to figure out how to manage this. In fact, they're blowing the situation up. The recent violence at the Temple Mount is just one example of how badly things are going there because of the administration's neglect. Netanyahu's based a lot of his actions and policies on the notion that the United States is always there to sort of be his excuse to pull back when he needs to. And he doesn't have that excuse anymore. So Israel is really getting itself into more and more trouble, and the solution is getting farther and farther away.
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought that Netanyahu's the European hot mic comments that he had were sort of shockingly telling to me, that the sort of basis for any real relationship between the EU and Israel he was laying out had to be basically, you can't do anything that I view as supportive of Palestinians. I mean, it just seems so outside of the I mean, it almost seemed like outside of reality. I mean, certainly I'm sure within the bubble he lives in, you know, it all seems very legitimate. But I mean, I guess the way world opinion is going, that struck me in and of itself maybe as the starkest contrast between sort of where Netanyahu is going and the impact of his actual actions.
Well, I think the thing about that comment that's interesting is it almost would have made more sense if it wasn't a hot mic comment. It plays very, very well to Netanyahu's base in Israel, which hates Europe. And feels that Europe is responsible for what they see as the entire Israeli left, as bedraggled as that left is right now. So it plays very well to his base. The fact that it was a hot mic comment, I think, tells us that Netanyahu's starting to believe this stuff, which makes him look at least a lot more unhinged than he's ever been. I mean, his policies have always been objectionable. Certainly those of us who are champions of peace and human rights have always worked against them. But Netanyahu has not been prime minister since 2009 for no reason. He's a consummate politician and very good at it. And it seems like now, under the weight of many scandals, his tenure could be coming to a rather ignominious end. It looks like he may be, that gives the impression anyway, that he may be cracking under pressure. And I think also one of the things that makes his situation difficult, sort of continuing the theme I started before about the U.S. not restraining Israel, the ceasefire in Syria that the U.S. and Russia agreed to, before that agreement happened, Netanyahu spoke to both President Trump and Vladimir Putin, expressing his displeasure at the idea that Russian troops would be securing the southern Syrian border, that area with Israel. And you know, one can understand that he would prefer troops that are more closely aligned with Israel. Hezbollah has certainly acted in that area. I mean, there's a, whether one agrees and supports his position or not, one can certainly see the logic in it. Mm-hmm. And that complaint was completely ignored by both parties. He spoke with them, they heard him, and they simply moved on as if he had not said anything. There was a sort of a nod to Netanyahu in saying, you know, Israel's security concerns will be taken care of, which all it really meant was, yeah, we know we're going to still have the Russian soldiers there doing that job, whether Netanyahu likes it or not. As far as we're concerned, that's good enough. If it's not good enough for Netanyahu, too bad. That is an attitude that Netanyahu never saw from Barack Obama. Obama was very, very concerned about Israel's security issues, sometimes more so than, you know, he really thought necessary, than he really thought was merited. He understood the political implications of reassuring Israel. He was constantly looking to reassure Israel on security matters, not on settlements, but on security matters. He was more conscientious, perhaps one might argue, than any president before him about Israel's security issues. And now Trump, who's Netanyahu's good friend, has completely turned his back on that question. And I think that makes Netanyahu very, very insecure.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that hasn't really gotten a lot of attention, even in Israel, and certainly not outside. But I think it's a big factor in why Netanyahu seems more unhinged now than he has been in the past.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that that's a great point, I think. And I wonder, just sort of tying it in and slightly sort of shifting this, I mean, Trump sort of, from what it seemed like, kind of goosing this GCC crisis between Saudi, UAE, and Qatar and some other nations, also kind of cut the legs out from under the idea that, well, they're coming saying, well, we're going to revive the Arab peace deal, blah, blah, blah. Now, whether or not that was realistic or not, now sort of the block of countries you were, you know, looking to sort of work with and leverage or do whatever, there's massive infighting. And so that's sort of its own thing that in and of itself, Trump's actions, I mean, it almost seems like, I don't know, almost seems like, I don't know why I'm not saying this is the obvious thing. You know, there's no real connection between how they're dealing with the different issues, even in the same region too, which just strikes me as dangerous.
It's very dangerous. And you're absolutely right. There's no policy here. There's no policy. There's no strategy. There is Trump and his impulses. And I think you saw this with the issues between Saudi Arabia and Qatar are perfect examples. You know, Trump goes, the Saudis treat him like a king. And he's very flattered. He loves them. He thinks they're the best thing since sliced bread. And he basically endorses their entire policy, which, again, takes the restraints off of them with regards to Qatar, who they've been trying to find a way to diplomatically blast for years because of Al Jazeera, because of their relative sympathy for groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, because they basically see the interests of the region differently than Saudi Arabia. Even though they're tentatively allies in many ways, but Qatar is also very open to dialogue with Iran. And, you know, there's a lot of differences there. Mm-hmm. Qatar is nowhere near as powerful as Saudi Arabia, of course, but the Saudis would love to go and find a way to diminish Qatari influence. So Trump opens that door and realizes that he's undermined all of the things that he said he wanted to do by doing so, because the Saudis took him at his word and said, fine, we can do what we want now. We have no American restraints. And then the Secretary of State has to step in and try to fix that problem, but he doesn't know what he's doing, and he doesn't have the president behind him. So the crisis is ongoing, despite repeated calls, mostly from Rex Tillerson, for them to find a way to make up, you know, just to make up and get back to the way things were. You have that situation going on. At the same time, you also have Israel alienating its possibly, arguably, its closest ally in the Arab world, in Jordan, with this incident with the security officer, the embassy officer who shot and killed two Jordanian citizens, comes back to Israel to what was essentially a hero's welcome without there ever having been an investigation. This has fallen outside, out of the headlines here, but in Jordan, people are furious about this. And, you know, the peace with Israel is not the most popular thing in Jordan to begin with. Mm. So you're having in Israel looking increasingly evil to the people in the Arab world. And the leaders are looking at this and saying, well, you know, any cooperation that we have with Israel that we thought we might be able to make a little less covert, that we might be able to do this a little more openly, that's out the window. Mm. So that really diminishes the potential for them to do a lot of the things that the Saudis especially were hoping to work with Israel on regarding both Iran and ISIS. And now we see that the Gulf countries are starting to realize they bought some real fool's gold with Trump. Just saw the foreign minister of the United Arab Emirates last Trump as completely unqualified, which, of course, as we all know, he is. So, you know, here's the case of the UAE foreign minister telling it like it is, but that's a big step to say that about an American president who was really backing what was ostensibly their agenda.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a very, very relevant point. You know, one other sort of interesting factor here that has been surprising me recently, and I'm curious what your thoughts. Were you surprised at all that – I think it was only Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul who voted against that sanctions bill when it came out of the Senate. I mean, I was shocked. I mean, I'm just very surprised that it seems to appear now that President Obama is gone that no Democrats really actually agreed with him on how to deal with any of these hot button issues. I mean, it just sort of seems, especially on the Iran deal, obviously that was a tough road to hoe, but no one really, you know, who even many people who voted for it don't seem to be stepping up on it. You know, even with Russia, whatever people may say, I mean, Obama, certainly he came in with the reset. I think he was cautious on how he dealt with Ukraine. I mean, you know, he was sort of going through it, but trying not to get too deeply taken in. It sort of seems as if that sort of mentality was only within, you know, his sphere in the West Wing. I've just been surprised how few Democrats who allegedly were supporting him for 8 years seem to not be willing to sort of follow a similar logic as he was, whatever the, you know, warts and contradictions of it may have been. It's just surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, in this case, it's absolute. The only, you know, the only people who voted against the sanctions bill were an independent in Bernie Sanders and the Republican in Rand Paul. So the Democrats voted down the line to support it. Now, of course, I think the primary reason they did that was they did not want to be seen as arguing against Russian sanctions, given how much attention they're paying to the issue of Russian interference in the 2016 election. Mm. But the fact that during the debate on it, no one brought up the even the concept of separating out Iran,
right,
and actually really separating out North Korea as well. All of these are very different issues that need to be approached in different ways. So lumping them together in one bill is probably not the best idea. These are serious strategic issues that need to be considered and approached very, very thoughtfully, especially when we're talking about both North Korea and Iran, where there seems to be a heading towards very, very destructive war. That is not something to be tacked on or added into a bill about Russian interference in the U.S. election, which is a very different, a serious issue, but a very different one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a problem. A lot of people right now are looking at the North Korea issue and thinking that's where war is going to come. I tend to believe that Trump will back off of that issue eventually, simply because that's what bullies do. North Korea has some sort of nuclear capability already. They have China behind them. That is a fight the United States may well not win. And if it does win, it will be a Pyrrhic victory.
Mm.
That's true of Iran, too, but I don't think it looks so much like that, because Iran is probably not, in the event of an attack, it probably won't get the same kind of support that, from Russia, that North Korea would get from China, for one thing. And Iran, it, at this point, doesn't have nuclear capability.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it isn't next door to a country that's as close to the United States as South Korea. So I think Iran is really the hot-button issue. In fact, just published an article, which people can see at my site, MitchellPutnick.com, about how dangerous what Trump is doing right now is, and his intention to destroy the Iran deal is unbelievably reckless and stupid. This is a deal that Israeli security people have praised as being very much in their interest. Americans have been behind this deal, despite the fact that it's politically somewhat touchy. It is, and the result of the United States pulling out would be horrific. Not only would it lead us down to a road to war, it would also isolate us, because Europe is not interested in renegotiating the deal. They like the deal. Everybody likes the deal in Europe. So, and China, Russia, obviously have no interest in renegotiating this deal. Only the United States is wanting to do this, and it simply isn't going to happen. So the United States does seem like it's incredibly intent on pulling out of the deal. Trump has already ordered his staff to find a reason for him to do it, so that he can at least sell to the American people the notion that it wasn't just his arbitrary decision, but that Iran had violated the agreement, which everyone agrees they have not done.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Secretary of State talking about how the Iran deal was supposed to make Iran a quote-unquote better neighbor, in other words, come closer in line with U.S., Saudi, and Israeli policy and be more friendly to the Saudis and Israelis, but that was never the intent of the deal. So now Trump is considering demanding access to military sites, which was a big issue when negotiating this deal. It was exactly what neoconservatives were pushing for, and exactly what the Obama administration said, guys, if you push for this, there's no deal, because no country ever would ever agree to such a thing.
Right.
You know, no country lets even allies, let alone people who are adversaries, come and inspect their military sites. It's just insane. It's a ridiculous demand. So that seems to be where Trump is going. And I frankly think that we're looking at it potentially. We're looking at a military conflict here that Trump is leading us to that would dwarf the Iraq war by a lot. And it's not getting anywhere near the attention. People are talking about it, but because of everything else that's going on between Scaramucci and Trump's whatever his latest tweet might be, people are just not giving it the attention it deserves. And it really, really needs to be looked at a lot more closely.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I think people in America in some degrees are also just have such sort of an ignorance around the issue of Iran that I think even the scale of what would take place there and the difference in the type of countries they are, as bad as Iraq was, you know, sort of the way it played out with that initial invasion not being that much and then the insurgency coming, wouldn't be the same situation in any way, shape, or form inside of Iran. But either way, we're going to have to leave it there, I think, for today. But Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us again. MitchellPlitnick.com, and you can follow Mitchell's writings there as well. Please go on and support. We are going to have to leave it there for our show here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.